This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw!
Hi, Benji!
Hello, everybody. It's your old pal Benjamin the Donkey, back again with more Limericks of Doom.
Benji, we're not doing lowercase Limericks of Doom today, remember?
Hee-haw!
We're doing your meta-Limerick of Doom, your limerick about uppercase Limericks of Doom. Two, to be more specific. It was your willingness to share the makings of that limerick that named this show, Creative Process. So, with that, the floor is yours.
You know, this idea occurred to me a half hour ago or so because part of my regular routine is after I've written a limerick, I review what I learned from going through the process that time. Sort of like a self-autodidact poetry study or something.
I get that. It's like I was telling you about what we used to do during semester break. Every semester, you just kind of stop and you do this review and you make the lessons learned a part of who you are and where you're coming from.
Yeah, it's self-discipline and it's self-improvement. So this time, my thoughts included being about exactly how the process worked, which was the question that you asked me a long time ago. And I tried to reach as far as I could to grasp the answer to that question. And I had the idea that my creative process was just neurons making connections, like that's how it works. And my neural patterns have developed in a certain way so that, for example, I could write this limerick this morning very quickly, knowing exactly what process I was doing at what time. And so why would I do one process instead of another? I think that it had to do with what stood out, what became aware, which would be based on the established neural patterns to some degree, and then some little exploration and so on. Anyways, when I was reviewing it, I could describe, if I could dredge it up or put it into words, the various processes that I use, and they don't always have to be in the same order and so on, but it's sort of like, where's the most stimulation or the most, where's the creative edge? What can I do something with here? What is the most, I'm not sure that's exactly right either, but where to start? What is the nugget there?
I want to back up and explore something that you said a moment ago, which was that which process you use can vary from one time to another. And I'm thinking maybe we're using the word creative process in a different way, because I'm viewing the creative process as being a unified whole. And apparently you're viewing it more like a toolkit, like something that you use one way one time and a different way another time. And you might start here, or you might start in the middle, or you might start at the end. I'm not sure just how you're conceptualizing the creative process.
So I'll tell you exactly how I wrote this limerick that I just wrote.
Okay. Would you do my editing a favor and first read the limerick?
Well, let me say a little bit more then. You know that I have been thinking about some kind of an advertising campaign for the book for the holiday season. And I've been mulling over how to approach that, you know, because what is the tone that I want to put across and so on, you know? And as you know, I've been thinking about that for weeks.
Yeah.
I sent a few copies of my book in digital version to old friends or people I wasn't really so much in touch with and so on, to kind of show them what I'd been up to. And hardly anybody responded. So that sort of reinforced this persistent theme of people don't want to hear about it. It's the cause of breakup of friendships. It's, you know, the doomer isolation. So that kind of struck me, that some of these people just didn't answer or something. Now, some of that is a technical problem, but that gave rise to the idea about, well, if you want to get rid of somebody, just tell them about doom. Basically would be the joke that came out of that. Okay, so that was the basic joke.
Rise to the idea for that limerick.
Yes, for the limerick that I will read yet. I'm just putting this in chronological order now. So that joke came to me, you know, maybe a week and a half ago or something, you know, and it was pretty good, you know. And then the other element that arose that I just sort of tacked on this morning was, you hear these things, there's two kinds of people in the world, those who, you know. So I sort of attached that in, you know, in the framework. Like you can get rid of people. Well, but some people you really want to tell, and in fact, I didn't get to develop this as much as I wanted to. You want to tell people who are your friends to warn them about doom, maybe, or to turn them on to the concept. There's people you may want to, for the best reasons, inform, okay? So that would be another kind of person. And I suppose, as we were talking about lists once before, I suppose that two was all that came to me, and I couldn't think of any other. If I could have thought of any other categories, I might have, you know, expanded it. In fact, I was thinking, I sort of went as high as three verses in sort of beginning to contemplate how the basic thing is there's two kinds of people, those you like and those you don't. And this book is appropriate for your Christmas giving, as the other joke goes, covers everybody, really. Those were some of the elements that went into this morning. It's basically an ad to go online in a few groups to try to improve my book sales.
Right. Promoting Limericks of Doom 2, which has been out now for how long? 2 months?
I think the paperback probably has been 2 months, yeah. This is what it is, okay? Two kinds of people to consider giving limericks of doom to this holiday season. Those you like, send them word via Ben of our years left, perhaps only 10. And for those whom you don't, send them this and you won't hear from them ever again. Yeehaw!
I was waiting for that.
I sort of came out today in this, you know, I finally got myself fucking stabilized, I think is what happened, in my regular unsocial life. I've been going through changes lately, and this is something that's kind of erupted out of the mess this morning. It just was its time to come. I haven't written anything for ages, months probably. Like, this is the first thing I've written in a long, long time. But what was impressive to me was that it went just smooth as silk, you know? The process. Okay, so now I had the basic ideas, which I've outlined now. The next step is the last line, the joke that you'll never hear from them again. There were various ways to say that too, but they all ended up with the word again. And I hate to admit this, but then I opened up my online rhyming dictionary and put in again and made a list of possible words that would work. Then technically it was just a matter of getting the last line organized. The last line was going to be the joke. You're not going to hear. And there was a number of different ways. And so finally I got the rhythm and everything to work right. And then I had the last line. And then it was just a matter of filling in the blanks. So there's people you like and people you don't like. People you like gets lines 1 and 2. People you don't like gets 3 and 4, okay? And then you got to tell the story about what you do with the ones you like and the ones you don't like. You already got your rhyme pattern. The first two lines got to rhyme with the last one. So then you do the first two or the second two. And in this case, I think I kind of jumped from one to the other. And incidentally, I have a longer version of the exact same poem with about 3 extra words in it. And I spent a long time debating which was better. And I just opted for the simpler version on principle that simpler is better. And then I added on the link for buying it from Amazon, and the rest is history.
It's a really interesting ass backwards way of going about things, to start at the end and work your way back to the beginning. I think it's really interesting.
The whole premise is in the title. We talked about different title possibilities. There's no way to fit in all of the necessary elements any other way.
So you're right. You do kind of need to mention 2 kinds of people in your title in order to establish the premise.
That's another thing that happens, interestingly, all the time in the creative process. You get stuck. There's no way to fit.
It's a very economical form, isn't it?
This is from Leonardo da Vinci, I think. No, it's from somebody else. That great works of art are not finished, they are abandoned. And when I can't fix it any better, that's when it's finished. And I involuntarily laugh when I finally get the thing, when it finally is finished, you know, when I get it right. I know that I did, because I always just laugh.
So there's a spontaneous laugh of delight when you get it in satisfactory form.
Very often, yeah. It's that.
You know that it's not ever finished.
Yeah, so, and then, because I know from lots of experience that when I keep fiddling with it, it just makes it worse. Well, really?
I know. I think I've seen that in other media.
Well, it happens with everybody, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Your own worst critic, you can always pick flaws that nobody else is going to see. And your attempt to repair them, though, is going to be totally blatantly obvious.
Yeah. 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 And that's why this is going to have to be posted momentarily exactly the way it is. Yeehaw.
Okay. So maybe you'll reach more of the Doomer community with 2 kinds of people. Thank you for sharing your creative process with our listeners, and I hope your exposure here on Sequitur outside of the Doomer bubble will stimulate a little more traffic on Amazon. And here's a bit of advice for would-be purchasers. It's not the sort of material for a leisurely evening of reading, and it's best to read a page or two or a section at a time in the order in which the limericks appear. So get the paperback and insert a physical bookmark and read it in brief sittings on the commode.
Yeehaw!
Both kinds of people sit on the commode, Benji. Next, let's hear from David Almalek-Walensky. You met David last time on Sequitur Exit Strategy when he read his poem Ghost Story and talked about his book, The Crane is Flying. And I had forgotten until after I posted the show the Ghost Story wasn't even written yet when The Crane is Flying was published by Dos Madres Press. So I decided to give David some time on Sequitur creative process to give us a sample from his published work. David?
I want to talk a little bit about your art form and what it is that interests you.
I love reading out loud, and I read out loud when I write. Not every time, not every word, not every draft. But always, sooner or later, and always at the beginning, because I hear what I write much more than I even understand it. I live with something inside me, which I call my sister. You know, that's tricky what it actually is. But like everything else that I live with inside me, it will show up as a poem sooner or later.
Last time you spoke of dreaming of your sister's death a year before it happened. Can you tell us more about that dream?
The images of the dream are the poem, The Anguish of Air. Remember, I've lived with this poem for almost 50 years. So here's The Anguish of Air. In the dream, they sealed the courtyard, the windows, gables. My sister floated like a feather, ascended. The sky was sealed. Henry, my friend, you raced like a poet, shaping channels in the clouds. It didn't save her. My sister flew out a cloudy window to the air. She started to fall. It was an anguish of air. It wouldn't hold her. She slipped down like a feather from a shot swan. The courtyard surrounded, the clouds streaked red. You spiraled with grief while old men sealed her life.
Wow. Old men sealed her life.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It means that I was latently political in 1969.
And so you were harboring some blame against some people for the fact that you lost your sister?
If anyone besides me were an expert on the poetry of David Walensky, which is not true, they would find that I am constantly trying to both be in the big picture and the small picture. And it's not easy. And many of my poems, which are not so good, just leak all over the place for that reason. This is a place where it just gracefully comes in as a killer last line. No pun. Yes, pun intended. But that's what it is. But you could read poems I wrote about birds. You could read poems I wrote about China. You could read poems I wrote about Baltimore. And you'll find I'm trying to constantly do that kind of stuff. But here I'm just looking at it and seeing, hey, you did it there because it was very much rooted.
I was very taken with the image of a feather falling from a shot swan.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of bowled me over.
Now that I'm an old man, I can say, gee, that's the kind of stuff you're always trying to do that you did there. Because you know that it's not just the image, it's the music of it. Floated like a feather from a... What's that, a spondy? And I just knocked over my camera.
But, just in time for the shot swan.
Yeah, right. I think it's a spondy, but whatever. There are people who know that backwards in their sleep. I know it in my sleep, but I don't know it wakingly. But the point is, yes, that's the point. The line floats and falls. And I didn't sit there trying to make it do that. It did it, and I was lucky.
And delighted, I'm sure. I mean, you recognized it once it had happened, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. The problem when you write, for me, is you never get it. So the question is how long you can remember why you wrote the poem. If I had $100 for every time I've changed one or two or three words, I could solve all of them, your money problems and mine. But the harder thing, of course, is to see, oh my God, this poem disappears. I wrote a poem that's 35 lines long and line 20 through 30 completely suck. I'm good enough to see that, but then all I can really do is tinker. So some of my really worst poetry is places where I just never was able to fix it.
But now your book has how many poems in it altogether?
Like probably 45 or something.
45 out of how many have you written in your 50-year career?
Oh, by now, I don't know, 1,000.
1,000 poems, only 40-something of which were published as The Crane is Flying. I get a poem in my inbox now and then, and I appreciate being on that very short and selective distribution list, but I'd like to give our listeners a chance to access more of your work.
A place where you can read two big chunks of my contemporary political-ish stuff, which is from the unpublished book, The Auschwitz Cookbook, is online from another guy who I do not know at all, whose name is Mark Ulysses. He also publishes a very physically beautiful online publication called Live Encounters.
The Auschwitz Cookbook?
Yes! Which Henry said to me the last time I spoke to him, that's a terrible name, David.
I think it's a great name. It's completely memorable, which The Crane is Flying, I thought was a beautiful poem, but it's not a very memorable book title. But I can see Henry's point. Such a title can be very alienating to a certain culturally wounded affinity group who would not necessarily make the effort I made to learn that creating fantasy feasts was a favorite pastime among the inmates of the concentration camp. Such people might reach some unfortunate conclusions about your political positions without ever reading the poetry, which speaks loudly and eloquently against genocide and other forms of oppression.
The Auschwitz Cookbook is not a great poem, but it is the title poem of that book. And it and about six other poems, one of which is Hiroshima Mon Amour, are online in two separate issues, although he's not publishing me anymore for whatever reason, from a year ago or so of Live Encounters magazine, which also has lots of very good essays on the state of the world and especially the state of nature in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But he's gotten more and more interested in poetry as he's gone on, and now he publishes whole issues which are just poetry.
So again, that body of work is published at liveencounters.net by Mark Ulysses. But there is no search box, so you have to know where to look. The Auschwitz Cookbook is under the 2016 LE Magazine tab. Mouse down to January and then over to David Almalek Walensky and then click. The other collection is titled Beggar of the World, and you'll find it under the LE Poetry 2016 tab. Mouse down to March and then over to David's name and then click. At the bottom of each of these pages, you will find a unique and entertaining but true bio of David and a link to his WordPress blog where there are more poems, pictures, and other writings. Thank you, David, for your work in support of peace on earth and goodwill among people of diverse ethnicities and identities everywhere. Next up, we have a musical offering by Stephanie Urbina Jones. Her song Born to Love was a big hit on Sequitur's Sacred Reciprocity, where we featured an eclipse debriefing with Peruvian curandero Don Oscar Miro Quesada. Imagine my delight when I found a song that directly addresses our creative process theme on her newly released Shaman Heart CD. And Lady Luck smiled upon me. I was able to interview Stephanie between stops on her current tour. I did the best I could with her audio track, collected from her phone while she was driving. But the song is from the professionally produced CD. So please bear with us.
Hello, Stephanie. And what's up with you? I hear you're on tour right now.
I'm heading from the southeast down to Texas for a Spirit of Christmas tour. We just came back from leading a intentional creativity journey adventure in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. And I'll be playing all over Texas for the next 2 weeks. And then in January, we'll be doing Shaman Heart, the Bittersweet Beautiful Ride, CD release parties in Nashville, Springfield, Illinois, Kansas City, Missouri, Florida, Asheville, San Antonio, Austin, Houston, and San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. So that's what's happening just in the next couple of months.
My goodness, that's a lot.
It's a lot. It's amazing. I feel blessed because the road is definitely rising up to meet me.
And you're going to keep time in there for your shamanic studies as well?
Absolutely. When we travel, regardless if I'm traveling more as a traditional artist of what I've done before or Shaman Heart, we're doing shamanic breath work and carrying that medicine. And we are starting the shamanic healing initiatory process with our own Toltec wisdom. And of course, we're taking journeys with students next year to Teotihuacan, San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and Oaxaca. And that's just in the first 5 months of 2018. You know, our company is Freedom, Folk, and Soul. That's our new congregation under Venus Rising Association for Transformation. So you can check us out online and see all of our amazing journeys on freedomfolkandsoul.org. So it's a busy time.
Between working on transformation and releasing CDs, it is a busy time indeed.
Yeah, it is.
I want to give our listeners a sample of your work. and talk a little bit about your creative process. So with no further ado, let's hear Chiseling Out My Soul from the album Shaman Heart.
By trade, I used to sit and watch him work, ask him questions, try to learn about the magic that he made, but he'd just smile and say, chiseling out my soul like a Michelangelo, and found spirit in the stone. I'm chiseling. Said, let love be your discipline, girl, carve out your experience, be authentic and be real. That's how my peace was revealed, by chiseling out my soul like a Michelangelo. You found spirit in the stone. I'm chiseling out my soul. But I think about him every day. You see, his words of wisdom, they guide my heart when I got a tough choice to make. He said, everyone's got an artist's eye, painting pictures with their lives. Everything you say and do is a frame canvas of your own truth. So I'm chiseling out my soul like a Michelangelo. You found spirit in the stone. I'm chiseling out. I'm chiseling out my soul like a Michelangelo. You found spirit in the stone. I'm chiseling out. I'm chiseling out my soul like a Michelangelo. You found spirit.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
I was so delighted to discover that song because it speaks to exactly what I want to hear you talk about, which is your creative process. Where do these songs come from?
I feel like these songs are like cosmic breadcrumbs for me. They come right when I need, I'm looking for something, when I'm trying to find an answer, when I'm bewildered, when I'm lost. Before, you know, the before the dawn, you know, in those moments, it seems like these little cosmic breadcrumbs are dropped in my heart, in my mind, and I know them. You know, they're like, I can feel the presence of something trying to speak to me. And for me, that spirit coming through and dictating, basically. And this song was a song that I wrote 25 years ago. I had just started therapy, and Max was my therapist. And I certainly did have to go and see him more than once a week in the very beginning. And he didn't necessarily say those words, but that was the experience that mm-hmm. came to me in the song. It's all there, Stephanie. You know, your soul, who you were born to be, the path, it all will be revealed if you just keep chiseling out your soul.
You referred to pre-dawn hours. Do you mean that literally? It comes to you like before sunrise in the early morning hours?
No, they come anyway. I mean, sometimes I fall in love with a melody. Sometimes I fall in love with a word. Sometimes I fall in love with an idea, with an intention. I had recently come from Italy and had just read a book, Agony and Ecstasy, which was about Michelangelo. Mm. And I really hadn't studied art growing up in a small town in Texas. And my husband at the time wanted to go to Florence. And I will never forget the experience of turning the corner and facing the David. Mm. And I felt the presence of this person in the stone. I felt the spirit in the stone. The spirit in the stone. And Michelangelo said a great teaching was that it was all there. You just had to chisel it away. And that image, those words played into me recognizing what was possible, you know, my personal freedom that I was not personally experiencing at the time. And that's why I say the songs come to me kind of as little messages for the future to hold on. They kind of are the little beacons of light for the future.
So that's great on the inspiration. But now what about the nitty gritty? What about getting the right number of lines and the right number of syllables and a refrain that works? And,
you know, I really will say to this, for me, it's like working in the clay. It's a feel thing. I am relentless on a lyric and a melody until I know it's done. And then I know it's done when I have that kind of sigh of relief. And sometimes I'll work on a song for 10 years. And sometimes I'll work on a song for 1 hour and it'll be done. So there's no any one way. It's just the way the song is supposed to be. And nobody knows except for me. And it's a relationship between me and spirit. And so there's inspiration and then there's perspiration, you know, and it's done when it's done. So this song maybe took 2 weeks to write. It came very easily. You know, like I said, I wrote it when I was 26 years old. It was beyond what I could understand and had certainly not lived yet. That's why, to me, it was me just translating or dictating spirit. So it's my job to get in there and work it out.
And what comes first, lyrics or melody?
It just all depends. This one came as the chorus. The chorus just came, and it was just so juicy, and I could feel it. It said exactly what it was intended to say. I can't even remember because it was 25 years ago how the verses went, but I'm still kind of amazed at the story that they tell and the point that they make.
You know, I've always heard you up on Dove Mountain with a very minimal ensemble, and this album is so highly produced compared to that. You've got major instrumentation and orchestration even going on. Once you've got the thing crafted, how do you communicate music to the other players to get them to do what it is you want them to do? Or do you give them artistic license in making up their parts?
Well, you know, of all the songs I've ever written, people wanted to have a copy of this for 25 years. People have been asking me for it. And I've recorded it a couple of times, but I never felt like I captured the energy, the intention of the song. So I came back from Teotihuacan on a journey this past February, and someone had gifted me the opportunity to start the project. So I went in to cut Chiseling Out My Soul first, and we didn't get it. So in September, we went back into the studio, and I had just a core group of musicians, the guitar player, Patterson Barrett, that plays with me on a regular basis.
He's great.
Yep. And then I had a percussionist and or drummer and a bass player. So in recording, it can go any way. And so what I feel like is the song is not mine. It belongs to all the people that participate. And it takes on a life of its own. And for me, I just know when I capture the energy of it. You know, I could and probably will record it at some point with just me and a guitar or me and a drum. But this album just kind of took on a life of its own with those three key players. And then I keep adding colors depending on what I feel like I want to translate and say. And as much as I love acoustic music, I love to have all these different colors to play with. And I'm really happy with how it came out.
I was noticing on some of the other songs on the album, there's keyboards in there, there's a saxophone, there's a little string, mini string orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Where are all these people coming from?
I've been a professional songwriter for 25 years and then an artist, a recording artist for 15. So I have a lot of great relationships with people. And so I just think of them, you know, we're the three of us cut with the engineer. And then I'm like, you know what? Mama's Gotta Sing has got to have saxophone. It has got to have horns. You know, it felt like almost a disco era freedom song.
Yeah.
I Will Survive. This was an album that I could do whatever I wanted. And so that's what I did. I just painted each song as its own picture. Mm-hmm. And once you start, you know, and you've opened up to using whatever instruments, it's kind of taking a course and you just keep rolling with it.
And what studio do you use? Is it always the same place?
Well, it's so funny you should ask. This album was started 15 years ago in a studio in East Nashville. And some of the tracks, just a couple of the tracks, we ended up pulling from the recordings that we had done 15 years ago. And I already had like a magic vocal on the track, but I sounded really young because it was the beginning of my freedom, trying to find myself, trying to find my voice, trying to heal my core wounds and all that stuff. So I sound like a little girl. So what I did was on those few songs, the woman that I am now, the artist that I am now, I sang with that little girl, with that young part of myself. And both of those voices are on there. And that's a really special part of the record for me. You know, that happened on Born to Love, that happened on Color My World. I couldn't erase what was already there because my essence had already been captured. But
right.
It wasn't reflective of who and where I am right now. So we just kind of made magic in that way.
Bridging across the decades with your own self. That's just amazing.
Yeah, this truly is, you know, people have been asking for this album from me for 20 years. And honestly, I used to feel ashamed that I hadn't, you know, because people wanted it and they wanted this medicine of these songs. And I felt ashamed that I couldn't give it to them. But I really understand that a lot of these came from my soul as messages, as medicine for me. And I had to catch up to them to be able to carry them. It used to be that when I would sing some of these songs, I would literally just break down. Because I just really wasn't emotionally evolved to that point yet.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, a lot of what you're expressing in these songs is very vulnerable and very naked.
Yes.
I can imagine that it's kind of like showing up naked on stage.
It is. This is the album that I feel, you know, as I head to Texas to start performing these songs, a lot of people, they don't know this side of me. They just see the kind of lighthearted artist that I am, and they don't know the road that came before to get there. So I'm sharing that now in this album, and I have felt very vulnerable in kind of delivering it to the world. But I know without a doubt, and I measure a lot of my life, well, if I was not to be here tomorrow, I really think about that. And I was on the other side or wherever we go, I would be upset had I not given life to this body of work and to these songs that help me so much.
Well, let us help you give life to this body of work and tell our listeners how they can find out more about your published work and maybe even acquire a copy of your album.
That would be wonderful. My name is Stephanie Urbina Jones, and that is Stephanie with a PH, and Urbina is Urbina Jones, StephanieUrbinaJones.com. I'm on Facebook and Instagram, and of course, you can get a hard copy autographed through my website. I'll send it to you, or you can download it on iTunes. And, you know, I hope you enjoy it. And I hope that in those dark nights of the soul, you find some peace and you know that you're not alone.
Stephanie, I want to thank you very much for taking time to meet with me here today.
Thank you so much. What an honor. I really appreciate it.
And we wish you safe travels, both in this dimension and in the great beyond. As our fourth and last interview, I'm going to play part of a very long conversation I had last Friday with another creative artist, formerly known as Zimft, the creator of the Sequitur theme song, as well as a couple of our musical offerings over the past year or so. He's also my younger son and the father of three of my grandsons. But with all of this name changing, I would prefer if you would introduce yourself to our listeners.
Okay. Well, I am Jason White, and I go by the name Strobus in my medicine work.
Would you describe for us the inspiration for this new name?
Sure. I did a rewilding retreat for a week with Daniel Vitalis, who I highly recommend to anyone who's interested in ancestral lifeways, in getting back to harmony with our biology and harmony with the world around us, the natural world around us. That was right around the time when I received the name Strobus, and I went to the retreat and used the name. And at the end of it, I just realized that I was a healer and that I was going to have to move forward in that context. It felt at that time like that was the best of who I was. And a lot's happened since then, and just gotten through some shamanic training, I've gotten a lot more solid and stronger in my approach. I have more of a sense of wholeness than I've ever had in my life that I can remember. I think I realized that this was going to be the way forward for me. In a way, it felt like another fracturing of identity, but I think it's more deeply held and more true to who I am. And I think also not giving up the name Jason White, but I wanted to kind of reflect that I'm kind of past the point where I need to be named by my culture and follow kind of like cultural impositions on who I should be called or what I should be called. And it's important. Names are extremely important. I've felt for a long time, you know, since childhood, that I didn't really like the name Jason. No offense. I don't have that strong of an opinion about it now, but somehow I just thought it didn't fit too well. It's kind of a boring name, Jason White. It's not very memorable. And I want to be a little more flashy in a kind of vanity kind of way. I'm, you know, egotistical kind of way. I'm a little bit more out there than that, a little more flashy than something simple and boring like Jason White. So anyway, I like Strobus. It's good. And the way it came to me was a beautiful experience, unforgettable and really deep.
Would you be willing to share it?
How it came to me?
Mm.
Sure. One night I was walking around my neighborhood and I couldn't really see that well. So, you know, so just walking, I'd walk the route many times before, but I ran smack into a tree, a branch of a tree, not a trunk. So it didn't knock me over or anything, but it brushed up against my face. And at that exact moment when it touched me and brushed up against my face, I had a very clear flash of insight and almost admonishment that said, get your house in order. And I was like, wow, it was really strong. It felt like it came from an other, and I didn't know, you know, what that could have been. So, you know, the next day I didn't really think too much of it, but I just couldn't leave it. I couldn't leave that behind. So the next day I went up there and that spot and looked at what tree it was. And it was the Eastern white pine, and verified it, because when I tried a couple of trees there, and when I brushed that up against my face, I knew that it felt exactly like what I'd felt the night before. I didn't have the same flash of insight or anything, but I felt the same, it was the same feeling on my skin. So I knew it was the Eastern white pine. And so I was talking with my shamanic teacher about it, whose name is Quinto. Shout out to Quinto. So Quinto advised me that it might be a good idea to do a dieta with Eastern white pine to explore further. So this is kind of exploring the plants from the inside. And so I did that. And when the diet opened, I had some very distinct visions of the plant spirit. And during the course of the diet, I was working on what that get your house in order was all about. I kept having kind of intuitions and dreams and visions of myself as the plant.
Mm.
So I took the name Strobus, which is the name of the eastern white pine. It's Pinus strobus.
So now you are Strobus pine.
I switch the names depending on the context. I use Strobus as a last name in my academic work because everyone is cited by last name. So I use Strobus as a last name so that they cite me as Strobus, if ever. But it's a first name, you know, in our sort of cultural. And the pine is just tacked on to anything that doesn't allow you to leave the last name blank. So Facebook doesn't allow you to leave the last name blank.
Right. So this vision was before you came back to Facebook?
Yeah. This dieta was in the spring of 2015. And I rejoined Facebook in October of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was still very tentative about where all this was headed and trying to make things work in the corporate world. And so it's been a slow process kind of integrating that diet and that naming experience. But I've since had lots of experiences with plant spirits. And I should say, by the way, that it's not as kind of airy-fairy as it sounds. For example, the fact that I knew it was the eastern white pine from the feeling of it on my face, that's an example of the livingness of something that I could identify species. And so if you think about it, every single different type of tree will feel different on your skin. If you tune into that feeling really closely, it'll have a different feeling. They all have different shapes of leaves, different textures of leaves, different textures of bark and branches, different fragrances of their flowers and fruit and tastes of fruits. So all of your senses combined give you the fingerprint of the living being of that tree or of that plant. And so you can identify the plant from all of that, even with eyes closed. You know, in Jungian terms, it's one of our cognitive modes is our sensory cognition. So it's all of our senses.
And the smell is much deeper in the brainstem.
Exactly. So these senses are reaching places that are really beyond our logical, rational reasoning. The engagement of these senses, the opening of these senses, and filling them with the being of the tree stimulate things within us that we can't really explain. We don't have the means to explain them, at least in terms of our subjective experience and our psychological experience. Perhaps maybe a little bit psychologically, some experiments could be done. Certainly in reductionism, we can explain them, you know, with neurochemical pathways and all that stuff. That's great, but that doesn't explain the subjective experience.
Would you connect the dots between the medicine work that you're engaged with and our theme for today, which is the creative process?
The medicine work, I think, opens up blockages in people, in myself, for sure. Removes often long-standing, self-defeating tapes and complexes that tend to hold us back from what we want to do in our lives. And that allows us to achieve states of creative flow a little bit more easily. I'd like to give you a chant, if you want, a shamanic chant.
Lovely.
So is there anything you'd like me to address for you personally in the chant? What's on deck for you?
A lot of audio editing, obviously.
Right.
I would love to see creative process uploaded by the 12th of December, which would have been your grandfather's 96th birthday. And of course, what's up for me is I'm really suffering in this apartment situation, and I'm eagerly anticipating word from Morgantown that there's an opening available for me at Unity Manor Housing. So that's what's on deck in my life right now.
Cool.
And I would love it if you would tell us the origin of this chant.
So this is part of the creative process.
Okay.
I don't have memorized chants. I open my mouth and let whatever happens come out.
Okay, go for it.
So this is going to be completely unique. I'll never repeat the same chant. Do you have any of your Florida water handy?
I just need to step over here a couple of feet and get me some Florida water. And I'll take a moment for an aside to our listeners to explain that Florida water is a libation that is used for a variety of sacred purposes in shamanism, as well as more mundane applications. This Florida water is an artisan product from my own kitchen, The ingredients and the process are described in the notes section of my Facebook. Suffice it to say here that some of the ingredients were months and even up to a year in the making, and the stepwise process was complete not long before Strobus and two of his sons paid me a visit this past summer. So I gave him a couple of 1 ounce dropper bottles. I had no idea we would be employing that Florida water during the course of this conversation. Okay, I'm set.
So I'd just like to connect with you on that deeper level that you brought up. When you smell something, it goes down below the conscious communicating mind and into a different type of consciousness, a deeper, more primordial, and potentially more powerful and translocative consciousness. So if we're both smelling the same thing, let's see what happens. So I'm just going to rub it in my hands.
Aho and spasiba.
Aho.
So all I did was imitate you and rub my hands together, but then I ended up putting it on my face.
Ah, okay.
As well, so that I could smell it more intensely. And I think probably there was a piece of suggestion there when you talked about the pine tree brushing your face. I decided that this Florida water belonged on my face. I really appreciate the DIY nature of your shamanic ritual. So can you describe the creative process to us?
Well, for me, the creative process is not really a process in the sense that most people think about it. It's not like a series of steps. The creative process is actually could be characterized by follow your nose, connect the dots. So there isn't a prescription, and it takes a different form for any given problem. And even in the course of pursuing a particular problem, many different ideas, approaches, directions may arise.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is the letting it arise. That's the process. That's the internal process. So if you have preconceived notions about where a creative process is going, then it's not a creative process. It's a preconceived notion.
Mm.
It can only go in that direction, because that's what you're saying it must be. So I've come to the realization that I have been a creative person, even though I've been in technology and have a degree in engineering. I've been a creative person all my life. And I happen also to have logical, sequential thinking skills, pretty strong in that regard as well. But my guiding light, my guiding force is the creative process, is the creative pursuit. And for that, I just dig in. I just start and I see where it leads me, and could be anywhere. I'm often very surprised where it leads. And that's very exciting. that's actually why I do it, because it's really exciting to connect dots that nobody's connected before and come up with something, a novel approach, a new insight. A simplification often is what happens to existing assumptions about a situation. There's quite a bit of runway, there's quite a bit of space to explore when you just come at the problem in an open-ended way, but you bring all of your skills and expertise into it.
You know that the Sequitur podcast takes its inspiration largely from Guy McPherson, who left a six-figure position as a tenured faculty member at a research university to pursue his own path. You, too, left a powerful position as a corporate vice president in a major IT corporation to follow your creative bliss. Talk to me about that decision.
I just realized that the corporate world isn't really for me. I don't do well in the politics. I don't care to play the games. I just want to create stuff. You know, and I've noticed that I tend to be a good chunk of time ahead of people in connecting dots, right? So when I got onto my sabbatical, I was just like, I have to trust myself. I have to create the culture because I don't want to be in that culture, the typical culture, at least as I know it. I know there's some really progressive and advanced corporations that are doing really good social and cultural things. I haven't found them. I just realized that I have to set the culture. I have to lead. I'm called to be a leader because I have a different view of the world and I don't compromise. You know, my view doesn't mean I'm rigid and I don't change. I certainly change my views and outlooks, but I don't do it because someone else said so. I do it because I got there. I arrived at that. And I can do that because I can kind of open my mind. I don't have preconceived notions or try to eliminate them as much as possible and open my mind.
I'm hearing an interesting amalgam of innovation and traditionalism.
Yeah, I mean, I can't forget or deny who I am and where I'm from and what culture I'm in and what my background is. And so I think wholeness intrinsically means that we have to include everything that we already are, but we have to see it in a different way. So I have been steeped in the corporate world, steeped in the technological world for most of my life. So when I came to medicine work, it is just a natural to think of it from that perspective. And I think that trying to say that healing can only be done in certain ways and certain modalities is limiting. That is very self-limiting and ultimately not useful. Because if I bring my whole self and my interests and my expertise exactly the way they are into the work, then I can be much stronger and much more effective. I see medicine work as using the tools and agencies that we have as human beings to help each other lead more fulfilling and more whole lives. In my particular line of medicine work, that often means technological tools, but also lately, it means more kind of traditional shamanic tools like plant medicines. Another part of relating to plants and understanding the intelligence of plants and the livingness of plants is that all beings are intelligent in understanding what's me and what's not me. In order to survive, all beings must have a sense of not me. What is predator? What is prey? What is nutrient? What is pathogen? And living beings, to the very simplest examples of single-celled organisms, react to the not me to defend against it, and they open up to the not me that is beneficial to them.
That's a beautiful argument for the universality of consciousness.
Yes. I mean, that is the ultimate of consciousness, is being just aware that there's a not me. Sure, yeah, reductionism and science and all that stuff, it's just chemicals, you know, swimming around and doing things based on chemical reactions. And yeah, okay, fine. So that's the chemical basis of consciousness. Great. You figured that out. But there's a subjective part of that too. There's the me and the not me that every conscious being has, including plants. So when you approach a plant and it brushes against your face, it's conscious that that's not part of the plant. You know, when you touch a plant, it knows. It has to, because otherwise it wouldn't have evolved. It wouldn't have survived in the world. Life has to know what's not me. And there's been science and studies now that show that plants do, in fact, respond to the world around them, but they do it in chemical ways that we can't really detect with our senses. They use different alkaloids. For example, they found that when insects attack plants, and start eating the leaves like caterpillars, the plant will start producing more quote unquote bitter alkaloids to deter and slow the caterpillars down. And not only that, but all the other trees and plants in the area somehow get the same message and start producing that same bitter alkaloid. So how does that happen? Well, they've figured out now, just by putting a bag over the plant, that plants produce dozens and dozens of pheromones. And so these pheromones, of course, are just taken by the wind all over the place. And so it stands to reason that other plants can detect those pheromones.
Yeah, they actually send out signal molecules.
Yeah. The other way they communicate, which has also been studied by scientists, is through the root system.
Yeah.
They isolated a couple of plants next to each other, and they gave one a radioactive carbon dioxide isotope, which the plant, of course, absorbs into its leaves as part of photosynthesis. And then they found that same isotope in the plant next to it. So this is all the work of Dr. Simard. I forgot her first name. She's on TED. It's S-I-M-A-R-D. Awesome stuff. Really, really cool. So to me, that's plant medicine. And I know a lot of people think, oh, it's got to be psychoactive. It must be, you know, like, oh, it's peyote or ayahuasca or whatever. Yeah, those are plant medicines. But really, plant medicine is like the whole cornucopia of plants out there. All of them are living beings that have something to teach. Some of them are not as like with it as others, you know, like a stalk of kale, for example. I mean, kale is pretty good medicine. You know, it's bitter. Some things are kind of bland and they're not really that interesting to us. We don't really respond to them very strongly. But I think it turns out that the more bitter a plant is, the more medicine that it may potentially have. And in fact, poisonous plants are also potentially powerful medicines. An example there would be the yew tree, which is extremely toxic. It contains a substance called taxane. And that molecule, taxane, is used in chemotherapy. Any higher than the smallest of doses, it's lethal. But in tiny doses delivered in targeted ways, it can cure cancer. And it has, in fact, the drug Abraxane has been very effective in treating breast cancer.
Well, we've come full circle, starting and ending with plants. I invited my other three guests to promote their current enterprises, but I'm going to delay that part of your interview until our next show, which is tentatively planned for the December solstice and will be called Presence, pun intended. How convenient for me that your new website is called Presence Tools. So I gave it away. Interested listeners can get a preview by visiting presencetools.com over the course of the next 2 weeks. Thank you so much for giving me such a big chunk of your Friday morning, for all the rich food for thought, and for the first-hand, in-the-moment sample of one of your several creative processes. Thanks also to Benjamin the Donkey, David Almalek Walensky, and Stephanie Urbina Jones for sharing their creative gifts, and to Zimpt for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
pleasure is so free.